The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. So there's one monster that is kind of a recurring villain in recent American history, and that's the debt ceiling. And it pops up every few years and threatens to take down both the whole government and possibly the global economy. And I thought it would be good to take up this issue. You know, what is the debt ceiling? What is Joe Biden likely to do about it? And then what are some actual possible solutions for making sure that this doesn't happen again? To discuss all this, I'm very pleased to have on Jeff Hauser, who's the founder of the Revolving Door Project, which is an excellent organization that does a lot of work in terms of, looking at who's in government, what interests they represent, and whether it's the public or some perhaps private interest. Jeff, maybe we could just get started with, I think it's actually good to like just describe what the debt ceiling is, because that's actually like, I'm recording this up here in Canada, and it's something that, you know, doesn't exist here. It doesn't exist in many countries. It seems like a very peculiar artifice of what American political culture, and it hasn't always existed. It's actually fairly recent in the long scheme of things. So what is this thing?
Great to be here, G. In 1917, Congress decided to try to make it easier for the Treasury Department to issue bonds and to deal with deficit spending. The United States was entering World War I, and the spending of the U.S. government was on the way upward. I mean, World War I and the Wilson administration are in many ways the beginning point of the administrative state in the United States, as well as the national security state, for better and for worse. But the U.S. government was becoming a bigger economic actor. And the debt ceiling is now associated with efforts to rein in government spending and rein in the executive branch. But that was exactly the opposite of the intent of the legislation in 1917, which was, again, to facilitate Treasury selling the debt necessary to keep the U.S. government going during World War I. And it didn't start to take on its weird modern context until the 1990s. I think there's an incident in the 1950s that might have slightly foreshadowed the sort of hostage taking that we've become all too familiar with in the 1950s. But this is basically in our lifetimes, you know, except for maybe your youngest listeners, development. And it's against the intention of the original law, and it's against logic and the broader constitutional structure of the United States. It's an incoherent mess, which says that when Congress passes appropriations into law, that is, they command the president to spend money, and the president signs that, or Congress passes overcoming a veto with two-thirds, that spending, those very specific requests that the executive branch must spend money, they don't count if and or unless the debt ceiling is raised. And it's a mess, and it allows for people in Congress to take the U.S. government hostage. And since 2011, when there's a Democratic president and a Republican Congress, Republicans take the American people and the world economy hostage. And then, you know, generally speaking, the Democratic president caves.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to point out the sort of 1990s origin of that, because it does seem to be a sort of product of that sort of, you know, Gingrich era, you know, sort of maximalist use of Congress to push the sort of Republican agenda. And also, I'm very glad, and we might want to just underscore this, that you mentioned the incoherence of this, because it seems to me that it puts you have Congress authorizing spending and then the president agreeing to it, and then the Congress being able to say that there's this further action that has to be done. But that puts the president in a sort of no-win situation, because, you know, either he has to agree to congressional demands to make the cuts, or he has to not spend the money that he's been authorized to spend, or to it doesn't actually make sense in terms of like how a constitutional structure works. Do you want to
Yeah, no,
say? Yeah.
it's a complete, absolute mess. And it is fascinating and horrifying that elites in our political process assume that the debt ceiling is the highest source of law in the United States, and any law that conflicts with the debt ceiling is null and void. The only law that must be respected is the debt ceiling. And there are just a few key reasons to think about why that makes no sense. The biggest is an argument that's associated with two law professors, Michael Dorff and Neil Buchanan. They call this the trilemma. They say that, yeah, it would be bad to violate the debt ceiling, but there are two other factors in deficit spending. There is the money that Congress has said the president must spend, and then there is the taxation level that has been agreed to. And if you keep the revenue side constant and you keep the deficit, the spending side constant, you cannot comply with the debt ceiling. And that leaves the president in a situation of either violating the debt ceiling, one statute, or making decisions about what spending he or she should or should not proceed with. And that is problematic on two basic levels. One, in the wake of Richard Nixon, there are laws limiting the ability of the president to say, I'm not going to spend that money. Congress should not have appropriated it. I'm going to impound it. That was one of the tools that Nixon did. I'm not going to spend money that Congress appropriated. And Congress said, no, like when we appropriate it, we mean it. You spend it. That is your job. You execute the laws. That's what the executive branch does. They execute our instructions. So the president has no ability to say, I like Social Security recipients and I don't like VA recipients. And I do think the Agriculture Department's important, but the Interior Department, what the heck do they do anyway? We're not going to fund them. The president doesn't have the authority to do that. So they would each day be making decisions about what spending to go forward on. And they'd be violating a whole bunch of instructions because they're not going to do a lot of spending has to not happen. And this is all in order to avoid going against the debt ceiling, the one law apparently that you cannot violate. And then there are constitutional issues, both the 14th Amendment, respect debts and obligations of the federal government, and also separation of powers, that the president is, again, taking the role of Congress in making decisions about spending. There's not only a statutory argument that the president can't do it, there's a constitutional argument, which is why the line item veto was held to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. The line item veto was Congress can give the president the authority to cut specific expenditures. And the Supreme Court said, even if Congress gives the president that authority, the president cannot wield that authority. So how could it possibly be the case that the debt ceiling gives the president that authority when the line item veto did not? And the line item veto was literally trying to give the president that authority, whereas the debt ceiling is accidentally backing into it by saying, cut spending somewhere, somehow, under some prioritization scheme that you unilaterally develop. It cannot possibly be good law.
Yeah, no, I think you explained very well the sort of incoherence of the situation. And but as you mentioned, like the sort of the history going back to the 1990s is that, you know, when you have a situation of a Democratic president and a Republican House, Democratic presidents have caved and, you know, are not willing to push through any way of like, you know, resolving this and, you know, like deciding whether this law that forces these impossible situations, you know, like actually should exist. And so what do you think? I mean, like, before we talk, you know, like what possible options are out there, you know, like this is an ongoing situation, but Joe Biden, I think, has given sort of contradictory statements, you know, some indication of some interest in the sort of 14th Amendment solution that you've hinted at. But where do we think Joe Biden is right now?
I think Joe Biden is boxed in by forces real and illusory alike. It is true that depending on how you poll it, typically, a majority of Americans are pretty concerned with the deficit and debt spending. A lot of this is misunderstanding whether or not the U.S. government, which prints the reserve currency of the globe, is similar to a household. It's also failing to understand that deficit spending would also include taking out a mortgage, which is an experience a lot of Americans do within their households and don't think is inherently irresponsible. But like deficit spending, yeah, that's taking on debt, right? Like, so the American people are pretty bad at understanding macroeconomics, and it's unfortunate, and there's a lot more to be done. But we're at a moment where in the next couple of weeks, are the American people going to be properly indoctrinated in modern monetary theory? Are they going to learn to be okay with deficit spending? I understand that, like, probably not to the extent to which, you know, you or I might prefer. So that is a political constraint of some sort. And there's also just the general view that people should be able to come to decision points. That they, like, we want everyone to agree, and shouldn't you be a negotiator? And those create, like, they are, I don't think they're super important political obstacles, but they are factors out there that a traditionalist like Joe Biden takes, I think, too seriously. Then there's just the sense that, like, because we're the more responsible party, we being Democrats, we're the ones who have to concede, because the other side really might be willing to shoot the hostage, which is why, I mean, my view is you have to figure out a way to get out of this game, because not only is this game going to be disastrous in terms of any compromise or negotiation that could possibly achieve results in the next few weeks being a disaster for the American people, and every time you negotiate, you make it more likely this is going to happen again in the future. You got to get out of this this repeated game of hostage taking, wielding ideological results for the far right.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I think the other sort of constraint, which might be self-imposed, is that I think the Democrats were kind of hoping, Biden was particularly hoping, that sort of more mainstream Republicans and sort of the center right would coalesce against the sort of hostage taking situation, that they're hoping the sort of business groups would understand the dangers of blowing up the economy. And I think they underestimated the fact that, you know, a lot of these business groups, you know, they basically are happy with the economic outcome if it means, like, you know, cutting social spending.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Biden administration has not signaled enough strength to the business community to panic, whatever the most responsible elements of the business community are. They're not panicked that this is going to there's going to be default, because they feel very comfortable that Biden's going to sell out. And again, they're going to like the sellout. So why would they bail him out? The other thing is that I think a large chunk of the business community is indistinguishable from the far right ideology. I mean, I think a lot of people who are making political decisions for the large corporations in this country are pretty ideologically extreme. I think there's just a old school view of 1950s, 1960s big business, in which, you know, those were not my favorite people in history, but there was a certain degree of sobriety.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Perhaps, you know, that's what happens when you have a 90% marginal tax rate. Like, you can get to be a little bit more community focused if you're not going to get super rich by running businesses. And since now you're going to get super rich running business, you are a more ideological factor. But yeah, American big business is not going to bail out Joe Biden. And I think even characterizing the McCarthy budget offering which is incredibly unpopular item by item, but making the American people aware of it and really taking it seriously, it's just an enormous communication challenge. And I think the Biden administration thought that getting McCarthy to release a budget would create a political leverage for the Democratic Party. But I don't think the Democratic Party right now has the political tools necessary to really punish Republicans for the extremism of the budget that McCarthy passed.
Yeah, no, it doesn't seem they had to have the sort of messaging capacity or the sort of like in the inroads among the sort of centrist media that you would kind of need to, you know, legitimize that message. And so it seems like, I mean, it seems like there's a genuine dilemma that Biden faces. But along the way, I mean, I think people have suggested, you know, like solutions in terms of like trying to, you know, get rid of the force of the debt ceiling altogether. And you've sort of, you know, gestured towards some of them, but I think it's actually worth spelling out, like, what are the actual options? You know, so that we can not just, you know, like try to best the Republicans in this particular negotiations, which doesn't seem to likely to happen, but actually to make sure that, you know, we don't have like debt ceiling crises in the future that, you know, force these impossible situations.
Sure. And so I tend to be an all of the above person. There's a lot of incredibly personal debates on Twitter about which is the preferred way to puncture the debt ceiling. And my view is to be derisive toward none of the options on offer, and I would support any of them. And whatever managed to get through to Merrick Garland, Janet Yellen, Jeffrey Zients, and of course Joe Biden, I would be happy with. I personally, so I support minting the coin, the console bonds. There are all sorts of mechanisms that take the debt ceiling unseriously enough that, okay, you're going to get us with one loophole, we're going to get you with a different loophole in law. And I'm okay with that. But my preference is to not find a solution to the debt ceiling, but to attack the legitimacy of the debt ceiling itself. And I think the best way to do that is there's a lawsuit from the National Association of Government Employees, which tells Yellen, like, you got to let us know that you are not going to call into question our ability to get paid. And so they have a very good argument to get into court. They have standing. Their salaries are very much up in the air. We have no idea whose salary gets paid in a world in which we hit the debt ceiling. We know not everyone's going to get paid. That's bad. People who are like, that is a legitimate type of uncertainty that a union can sue about. And as we described earlier, the debt ceiling, like, there is no scenario under the debt ceiling in which these people can be made to feel certain. We just don't know, because it's like daily revenue. We don't, like, the revenue, we hit X date, X plus one, we get this many billions in. We normally, you know, pay, you know, 1.5 times that then on the next day. So 50% of spending has to be cut. I think, so that lawsuit, which has been filed in Boston, that's an important lawsuit. And they're suing the US government. My view is, Janet Yellen and Merrick Garland, you do not defend that lawsuit. You say, you got us. You're right. The debt ceiling makes no sense. We agree that we will have to pay everything that we owe. And you can cite the 14th Amendment, or you can cite the trilemma incoherence argument that I made earlier, either or both. And again, I'm in all of the above. I think both apply here. You make that argument and you don't sue. You just don't defend. You say, yep, the plaintiff is right. Now, third parties can try to intervene. I don't understand. I cannot think of a third party which has standing to say the debt ceiling has to be followed, or else, I don't know, but like some bondholder will claim that it like impacts their value, even though it kind of goes in the other direction. Let them try to make their standing argument, see if they get into court, and then beat them even if they get into court. Maybe someone proves standing, maybe someone doesn't. But I think if the U.S. government says, we will not defend this lawsuit, we just cannot. It is There's just no good legal argument that the 14th Amendment, I mean, sorry, that the debt ceiling is coherent. I think that wins. And I don't understand how it loses. Like, Congress does not have a right to intervene. Congressional standing is generally does not exist in courts. And like, if the economy is going to be destroyed, let's have it be destroyed by the Republican Supreme Court, which we need to go after, which is the enemy of the people. I think, like, let's just call the question, is my approach. That gets you out of negotiation and gets you into, should it be okay for this law to destroy the world economy? I think that puts you in a much better circumstance than debating what cuts are needed to, quote unquote, get our fiscal house in order, which is not so far a winning political strategy.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. It puts you in a sort of more hospitable political terrain in terms of, like, you know, you want to, it gives you the battle you want to fight rather than the battle the Republicans want to fight. And I'm glad you mentioned the court, because it does seem to me that there are parallels here with this sort of larger question of what happens when you have the Republican and their sort of base of power act in such a lawless way, as we've seen the Supreme Court do. And, you know, as I think this innovation of the debt ceiling starting in the 1990s is, it seems like the Democrats are torn between two different instincts, which is, like, one is, you know, you have these bad institutions and bad forms, but you try to work within them because you want to preserve the legitimacy of the system. And the other is to just say, well, no, actually the way forward is to, you know, call into question their legitimacy and whether they can actually decide these things, and to, you know, challenge them politically. And it seems to me, you hear Democrats on both sides of this, you know, the sort of institutionalists that want to try to work within the existing structures, even though, you know, they lead to bad outcomes and are politically disadvantageous to the Democrats, and people who are, like, you know, thinking more seriously about challenging, you know, both the legitimacy of the debt ceiling and the legitimacy of the, you know, Republican courts. So do you think, like, what are the chances that, I mean, I think, would we agree that, like, Joe Biden is very much a kind of institutionalist, and, like, his whole orientation is to try to preserve things, to make the system as it exists work, and that he's not going to be able to get us where we, where you and I might want the Democrats to be?
I had been increasingly optimistic. I'd say the tenor from the last few days has been discouraging. Some of that's about Yellen. Some of this is that I just, the more I think about it, Merrick Garland is the key figure. And I think Merrick Garland is the single most disappointing nominee of the entire Biden administration. I think that the Republicans might make this happen, though. I mean, I think we should, I do not want to have to rely on Republicans being unwilling to accept a W and just going too far, but there is a chance that they just actually antagonize Biden and Zients too much, and then they fight on one of the many terrains available to them. So I'm not sure, but I think the tendency is bad, but I think it's really important for activists to make it known to key political players that they are aware that there are options to fight. It's not negotiate or else. There are alternatives. So it's just really important for activists to let their representatives in Congress know, let the White House know, and let the organizations that they are active in know that they should, because there are a lot of organizations who are fighting within the parameters that the administration wants them to, which is attacking the McCarthy budget and saying, like, we shouldn't be playing games, but not urging the administration to figure out a way to slay the debt ceiling monster. They should be urging slaying. And I think people who are contributors, grassroots contributors to organizations, have an ability to make themselves heard and tell the organizations that they support that you need to fight against the ongoing nature of the debt ceiling. It is a catastrophe. It is an avoidable catastrophe if the executive branch has spine. And we need to have higher expectations. We need to expect spine. If we concede that our leaders will be feckless in advance, then they certainly will be feckless.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Like, both in terms of strategically what people can do, and then also I want to just loop back to a point that you made about how the Republicans could force Biden's hand on this, which is, like McCarthy has like just a very, small majority in the House, and it's actually getting smaller. I mean, like with George Santos in kind of legal trouble, the exact size of that majority is even up for grabs. And what that means is that, the most right-wing Republicans get empowered because they can, hold McCarthy hostage just as he's trying to hold Biden hostage. And so it's not clear to me that like anything McCarthy can agree with Biden on is something that all the Republicans can agree on. And then McCarthy needs to get all the Republicans. And I think you would only need a handful of really, extreme Freedom Caucus Republicans to like just, create a crisis. So it does seem like, it's not just in Biden's hands, it's also in McCarthy's hands. And the story is still going to be is still playing out.
Yeah, I mean, and then the only dark note in that is the Problem Solvers Caucus and whether or not there'd be some Democrats who would go along with a strong majority, but not unanimity among Republicans. So if there were 200 Republicans and 18 Democrats, that could get you to a very bad bill.
Yeah,
So
no,
that's
that's
another
us.
thing that where we need pressure from the grassroots is for your Josh Gottheimers of the world to not think it's worth selling out the Democratic Party on.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm really glad you mentioned all the grassroots efforts that need to be done, because I think too often this is discussed at the level of high politics as if it's just a matter of the White House and the Democratic the Republicans in Congress and Republican leadership. But this is an issue that seems to be like very existential, like for a lot of Americans. And I mean, that might be the missing component that gets us where we want to be, which is that if you had a Democratic base that's engaged and takes on pushes not just the party but the sort of activist groups, then we could enter into a more hopeful dynamic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good. So this is actually turned out to be a surprisingly optimistic, or at least there are rays of hope. And I'm really glad, both for this discussion and in general, the work that the Revolving Door Project does of like actually thinking about, solutions that are possible, even within the sort of gridlocked political system. So thank you.
Thank you. Yep, we try to make at least some lemonade out of lemons.